contemporary thought is characterized by a certain schizophrenia. It likes to celebrate modern science as the paragon of modern rationality and often uses it as an argument to declare religion debunked, outdated, irrational, and behind the times. At the very same time, the contemporary mind can defy objectivity and consider reality a mere subjective construct. It can, in this way, think itself the subject of choices that are almost limitless. We shape our identities physically as well as by narratives that we tell about ourselves, and we do so unmoored from anything that could set limits to the validity of the stories that we tell. Genetics, biology, gender, and even reason, if not the very notion of truth itself, are considered oppressive if they try to limit our choices. Increasingly, this ideology of choice clashes with the results of science, for example, with evolutionary biology, when the latter insists that there are differences between men and women. But for the most part, people are willing to allow these thoughts to coexist in their minds by compartmentalizing their worldview. Once we become aware of this contradiction, though, we will see the clashes and inconsistencies and perhaps nowhere more clearly than in the realm of free will. For here, the very ideology of unlimited choice must claim that we have free will to an almost unlimited degree, while naturalistic scientism explains to us that neurophysiology and genetics show such choices to be an illusion. Now, even those who do not share much of the contemporary mindset will have to ask themselves what they think about the reality and limits of our freedom. It seems obvious that the truth must be somewhere in the middle between these extremes. And as we will see later, this is exactly where we can find St. Thomas Aquinas. But first, we will ask ourselves how we should think about recent claims from the realm of neuroscience. In recent decades, the side of the determinists has found apparent support in the well-known experiments of neuroscientist Benjamin Libet, beginning in 1985. Libet asked his subjects to wiggle a finger at any time within 30 seconds, without planning ahead. The subject was to note the position of a dot on a timer, faster than normal Libet clock, when he was first aware of the wish or urge to act and press a button at that time. At the same time, his brain activity would be monitored for its activity. And as it turns out, Libet found that there was some brain activity preceding the conscious awareness of this urge and the subsequent pressing of the button. This preceding brain activity he called a readiness potential, picking up the German Bereitschaftspotential discovered by Lüder-Deke and Hans-Helmut Kornhuber in 1964. In Libet's experiment, this readiness potential preceded the consciousness of the subject by a significant 400 milliseconds. Although the numbers in the literature vary between 350 and 500, and later variations on that experiment claim to have found up to a full seven seconds, if not more. This seems to suggest that before we make our conscious decisions, our brain has already made this choice for us before we are aware of it. Our choices thus seem to be only the result of unconscious deterministic causal processes in our brain, which have nothing to do with free will. Free will is therefore an illusion, a projection, or later confabulation, as it is called, of our conscious minds. To sweeten this bitter pill for our ego, Libet suggested that we might still have at least a veto over these readiness potentials. The readiness potential sets in at 350 milliseconds, but up to 150 to 200 milliseconds, the time of our conscious click of the button, we can still veto that click. Experiments in which the subjects were asked to veto their urge indeed showed that the readiness potential then peters out at about 150 to 200 milliseconds. And so it is suggested, while we might not have free will, we may still have free wound. But still, it seems that this is another one of our nice delusions that about ourselves that has been debunked. About human beings being something special, having something more than the animal kingdom, or being something more than mere matter, maybe a spiritual soul with rational faculties. Though one wonders what kind of resentment drives people to think that this is a reason to celebrate, it is always reported with great excitement in popular media, usually accompanied by a picture of a brain scan, this fast-acting solvent of our critical faculties, as someone has called it. Only some get concerned when subsequent experiments show that the ensuing disbelief in free will is correlated with higher instances of cheating on tests and other delinquencies on duty. Perhaps on the positive side, this realization can lead to more empathy. Jerry Coyne, for example, claims that by losing free will, we gain empathy, for we realize that in the end, all of us, whether Bernie Madoff's or Nelson Mandela's, are victims of circumstance. Unfortunately, though, this cuts both ways. If every criminal is a victim, a claim that increasingly has made its way into our courts of criminal law, then also every victim is potentially a criminal. Perhaps then every citizen should undergo a background check for future crimes. For example, brain scans for students in schools or travelers at the airport. After all, with advances in science, it is claimed, we do no longer have to wait for readiness potentials, but can predict behavior much earlier, detaining people for crimes that they have not even thought of. Raymond Tellis calls this outlook the second wave of phrenology, phrenology being an 18th century attempt to deduce the mind from the skull. Spirit is a bone, der Geist ist ein Knochen, as Hegel characterizes this theory in his Phenomenology of the Spirit. Certainly our technology to investigate skulls and neurons has become much better than that of the 18th century. But fMRIs still have to penetrate the skull, and their results are known for their unreliability, as both Raymond Tellis and Alfred Mealy point out. This is true especially for the higher cognitive functions, which would not surprise any Thomist, knowing that the brain is not the organ of thought. And locating anything in the brain is messier than it might seem, for the brain acts as an integrated unit. Even something like the notion of a hammer is located in different parts scattered all over the brain. The same regions can serve different functions, and the same functions can be found in different regions. The studies that make spectacular claims about the readiness potential preceding consciousness by 7 seconds are only 60% accurate, which is barely more than chance. And this for something like a rather vague impulse. This readiness potential then amounts to nothing but a slight bias, which is no threat to free will, as Mealy notes. This readiness might, this reading might just register a mere predisposition on which we do not have to act. More generally, one should soberly assess what can really be concluded from such experiments. A particular kind of action, wiggling a finger, has been shown to have readiness potentials preceding it in the brain. Assuming that this indicates a causal correlation, and we'll have to ask questions about that, then all one can conclude is that certain types of action are caused by certain brain states. Nothing has been shown with regard to other types of actions associated with free will. In other words, Libet might be committing the fallacy of hasty generalization. Also, what about the power of vetoing our urges? Someone who believes in free will would certainly accept such a veto power. But how can Benjamin Libet account for it? If this veto is ascribed to us as an instance of free willing on the model of Libet, then it would require yet another readiness potential. For we would then need to experience another urge to not follow through on the first urge, or an urge to follow Dr. Libet's instructions to veto our first urge. As Jerry Coyne rightly notes, quote, from the standpoint of physics, instigating an action is no different from vetoing one, and in fact involves the same regions of the brain. Yet none of that can be found. It cannot be the case, for the absence of something is not another material thing in the brain. Negation is not something material. Only minds can deny. It is indeed an expression of freedom, but none that we can account for on Libet's model. Nor is a mere veto a sufficient account of freedom. It would reduce us to the predicament of Herman Melville's Bartleby in Bartleby the Scrivener, who responds to the invitation to join the meaningless mechanisms of matter and the modern life by repeating, "I prefer not to." It is easy to be taken in by wild claims of neuroscience if we do not reflect on the status of science in general. For these very sciences, in their very act of denying free will, must claim it. Otherwise, their very truth claims cannot stand. One proponent of this view, for example, comes to the conclusion that in what is visible to neuroscience, there is no distinction between conscious action, reflex, and disease. But this would imply that this very neuroscience itself is indistinguishable from reflex and pathology, because doing science is itself one of those activities that neuroscience can observe in the brain. No science, including natural science and neurophysiology, is possible if it does not allow for rational argument. But rational argument requires us to be free to follow the argument and to go where the premises lead us. If this is determined by readiness potentials as well, then we are not following reasons, but causes. We are following not the prescriptive laws of logic, but the descriptive laws of nature. Not arguments, but brain physiology. And that physiology might as well be pathological, without us being able to know it, because that evaluation requires precisely the rational argument which it makes impossible in principle. It is important to make these meta-reflections on the practice of science, because this is what we lose sight of when we stare at brain scans. We forget the larger background in which science itself operates and in which it makes its abstractions and proposals. This background is what Husserl calls the life world, in which and for which science operates and in which it remains rooted. It is with this subjective background and its larger space of possibilities that science formulates its deterministic views and hypotheses. As Robert Spemann, my teacher, points out, the denial of free will forgets how we define our very notion of determinism in the first place. We tend to take that notion of determinism for granted, but if we are asked to define what we mean by determinism or necessitation, we could do no otherwise than defining it negatively, namely as the negation of all alternative possibilities. Determined is that which has no alternative possibilities. In terms of modal logic, possibility is thus more fundamental than necessity, because necessity presupposes the possibilities that it denies. Now, our primordial understanding of such possibilities, Spemann claims, is in turn derived from the experience of our own possibilities, who, as free beings, understand their life world through such possibilities. And so, once more, neuroscience, in denying freedom and claiming determinism, must presuppose it. This forgotten life world also forms the background of Benjamin Libet's experiment and others of its kind. It is in the life world, preceding the experiment and outside the laboratory, that we find the subject's free choice, namely, to enter the experiment as participants in the first place. As physicist Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker notes, freedom is a prerequisite of the experiment. Only where my action and thought are not determined by circumstances, urges, or customs, but by my free choice, can I make experiments. End quote. Making experiments presupposes the ability of the subject to follow through on promises and commitments to cooperate with the experimenter, including to report truthfully and not to lie about what he is doing in the machine. If subjects had no free will, they would be unable to guarantee for their future behavior. Again, it is important to make these meta-reflections because it is precisely what is lost in the blind spot of popular neuromania, as Raymond Tellis calls it. But it is not the only argument that needs to be made. A further argument against neurophysiological determinism concerns the very concept of what it denies, namely the concept of free will. In Benjamin Libet's experiments, this concept is implied in the very setup of the test. for Libet asks his subjects to press the button when they experience an urge to act. The first thing to notice is that this makes the whole experiment a self-fulfilling prophecy. It measures an urge to act. What else would that be if not a readiness potential? Why would we expect any other outcome? One does not even need to do the experiment. It is quite predictable. To be asked to notice an urge is basically the same thing as to notice a readiness potential, and so this is not very surprising or illuminating. In the words of Raymond Tellis, the experiment treats individuals as passive respondents to stimuli and then discovers that they are passive respondents to stimuli. It also raises the question of what is implied here in this notion of freedom and what it is supposed to be. Edward Faeser notes that to be moved by an urge is, if anything, rather the opposite of a free action. How so? To begin with, we may note the passive formulation. The subject of the experiment is asked to wait until this feeling or experience arises. That is, until the moment the agent experiences the will to move. Is this what we mean by free will? Is it an experience in which we are merely the passive bystanders and observers of an experience, not the doers or enactors of an intention? If there's any sense in the notion of free choice, then it is the notion of something that nobody else can do for us, let alone any other thing, including our own brain. In Wilder Penfield's earlier experiments, a doctor could raise the patient's arm by triggering a particular region in the brain. But the patient remained aloof, saying, "You did that, not I." The same was true for cognitive states. The doctor could elicit memories by stimulating certain areas of the brain, but not beliefs. Believing, too, includes an element of freedom. It is something I need to do myself. Nobody can believe for me, just as nobody can think for me. Likewise, we cannot be passive bystanders of our own decisions, if indeed they are an expression of free will. Yet Benjamin Libet's setup asks us to let our choices be determined by something else than ourselves, of which we are then merely the observers. In short, this is not a paradigm of free will, but indeed for urges that might arise in us involuntarily, such as an urge to sneeze or to vomit. Does Libet really want us to consider sneezes or vomiting a paradigm for voluntary actions? But there are more problems. The setup not only makes us passive bystanders, it also makes free will into an experience of feeling, in this case, the feeling of an urge. But is free will really something like a feeling? I would suggest that it most certainly is not. It is not even a feeling of spontaneity or creativity. The intuitive appeal of an urge as a paradigm case seems to come from the fact that it arises from within and not from external compulsion or stimulus. It therefore suggests some kind of spontaneity. But a feeling of spontaneity is neither a sufficient nor even a necessary condition of free will. In fact, inasmuch as feelings are sensual, they will involve some physical organ or have some brain state correlated with it. And precisely to that extent, they will not be free. It is completely unsurprising that we find some readiness potential to exist for such feelings because such feelings do depend on physical states. Because a feeling is passive, it arises based on things other than itself and on further facts of physiology or sensation. For example, I cannot choose to be in love or to hate or to desire food. Such feelings are precisely not in our hand. They are an obstacle to free will, not its paradigm. That is why we can act freely without any feeling or against all of our feelings at once. We have already illustrated this with our ability to make a promise and follow through with it regardless of any feeling. More generally, I think it is a mistake to identify free will with an experience or to prove it by an appeal to experiences. So Proponents of free will do the same on their own often, and I think that's a mistake. An appeal to the evidence of freedom in our inner experience is vulnerable to counter-arguments that declare these experiences to be illusions that have further causes. Historically, this appeal is related to a reduction of free will to a mere exertion of efficient causality, independently from any consideration of final and formal causality. This arises actually with medieval Franciscans, John Packham, Peter O'Leary, and William of Ockham, for example. It may also be found, skipping another example, but it may also be found in William James's definition of the will as an effort of attention, which may have been what Daniel Dennett had in mind when he caricatured notions of free will as some sort of radiation generated by gritting the teeth and saying, move, move, move. William James may also have been the one who solicited Wittgenstein's critical question, what is left over if I subtract the fact that my arm goes up from the fact that I raise my arm? If in answer to that question we are looking for some internal experience of efficient causality, then we will indeed draw a blank. To that extent, Wittgenstein is probably correct. Nevertheless, we should be able to distinguish the free act of raising our arm from the pathology of Dr. Strangelove's alien hand syndrome, if you know that movie. But for that, we must look in the right place, and none of these authors, including Dr. Leavitt, does. When it comes to mere efficient causality, the best we can do is to notice not an experience of efficient causality, but the lack thereof. If anything, it is the experience of an absence or of a gap, as John Searle calls it, a lack of sufficient psychological antecedents. But that by itself is also not enough. What is missing from all of these accounts and what is paradigmatically developed in Thomas Aquinas' thought is the formal and final causality of our free will. These elements are evident in the role of deliberation that is essential to our free acts. Our free choices are not based on feelings or urges, but on rational intentions, on reasons and thought. We can see this in the fact that we do not consider ourselves to be free when we do not know what we are doing. It's a thought experiment that I learned from Robert Spemann. You can imagine somebody putting two envelopes in front of you on the desk, you know, and one contains a $1 million check and the other your death sentence. Then you're told, now choose. Let's say you choose and then you pick your death sentence. What are you going to say? I didn't want that. Yes, you did. You chose it. You know, it's your fault. Nobody did that. Nobody else did that. But you're right in feeling that this is not something you wanted because you did not know what you were doing. We don't consider ourselves free if we don't have the ability to make an informed choice. So knowledge is a necessary condition, and in its absence, free choice does not exist. This is why invincible ignorance excuses. Now, where in Benjamin Leavitt's experiment does this knowledge or deliberation occur? It does not. Not only does it not occur, but it is exactly and explicitly excluded from the experiment. The subject is asked to wiggle a finger without planning ahead and without thinking. The experiment purposely, by definition and instruction, eliminates a necessary condition for free choice. This is not the end of the story, however, for here our previous reflections on the larger context come into play. Only if we take that step back from the scenario will we see that in the background of the experiment in the life world, an actual choice of free will is indeed happening, one that involves reason and deliberation and the planning ahead that Leavitt wants to exclude. But this choice is made much earlier and in unacknowledged ways underlies the whole experiment. It is the choice to participate in the experiment in the first place. The wiggling of the finger has nothing to do with free will. Rather, the decision and deliberate commitment and promise to enter the procedures is the true act of free choice. And here is where we find deliberation, namely the planning ahead and precisely the decision in advance not to interfere with the urge. That is, in the decision not to interfere with something else that is not our decision. It is neither the urge nor the veto of the urge that constitutes the free choice, but the decision not to veto the urge, or the reverse, as the case may be. Artificial though this experiment seems, many of our choices might indeed be set up in a similar way. Consider how you got up this morning. How did you get up out of bed? The alarm clock might have startled you out of sleep. No act of free will there. But then you had a choice. You could follow the call of duty, or you could turn off the alarm clock and go back to sleep. Suppose you decided to get up. You might not have done so immediately. Usually it takes a little while. But then you suddenly find yourself outside of the bed. You might not quite know when and how exactly it happened, but there you are. Now, what did happen here is the following. You made a decision to get up and get out of bed. That was your free decision. But you then waited until you or your blood circulation was in the right place to actually make the move. The move itself was triggered by something else, blood pressure, readiness potential in the brain, or whatever. Nevertheless, this move was governed by the choice you made earlier. You chose to allow yourself to be determined by your physiology or brain. Many other choices are of that kind. If we perform certain actions, we might make one act of will that governs all the more detailed motions. We might decide to utter a thought. But not every word or letter of a word is uttered with a separate act of the will. If we play tennis, then after deciding to enter the game, we let our trained reflexes take their course. If we had to decide on every twitch of our muscle, we would be too slow to hit the ball. Nevertheless, we do not play against our will, but voluntarily. We decide to play by our free choice. Our reflexes are not an obstacle to our freedom, but its tool and expression. We freely make use of our neuroplasticity and our readiness potentials. Entering Dr. Leavitt's experiment may be similar in kind, with the difference that we can enter serious deliberations about whether playing tennis is good for our health or whether we should defy duty in the world by staying in bed. Wiggling a finger, by contrast, is not much to deliberate about. After all, what serious reasons could we entertain to do it or not to do it? Nothing else seems to hinge on that choice. And this is the point at which some more recent experiments pick up. These are experiments that aim at clarifying the exact role that the readiness potential plays in the wiggling of the finger. All that we have is the fact that this readiness potential precedes the wiggling of the finger. But is that a case of straightforward causality? A mere post hoc is not a propter hoc, even if it happens regularly. The cock's crow may always precede the sunrise, but the cock does not make the sunrise. In order to know that, we need to know certain counterfactuals, for example, about what would have happened if someone had killed the cock beforehand. Would the sun still have risen? Or what happens in those cases in which someone did not wiggle the finger? But this we are not told. As Alfred Mailey notes, we don't know whether sometimes, even though the person didn't go on to flex, there was a brain activity like what was going on in the participants a half second before they did flex. If there was such activity in those non-wiggling cases as well, then its role cannot be causal. But we don't know that. Edward Faeser also points out that Leavitt did not show that the neural activity is invariably followed by flexing. In fact, the veto power seems to rule that out. So even if the readiness potential might turn out to be a necessary condition for flexing, it has not been shown to be a sufficient condition. It could be that it only happened in conjunction with an actual choice without causing it. And this is indeed what a new award-winning study suggests. In 2010, Aaron Schurger from the National Institute of Health and Medical Research in Paris studied spontaneous fluctuations in neuronal activity. And this is something like an ongoing electrophysiological noise that rises and falls like the tides and waves of the sea, something akin to the changes in the weather or in the stock market. Certain patterns and peaks can develop by random coincidences. Readiness potentials are of that kind. It was suggested and shown in tests that we, as well as the monkeys in the study, can use these readiness potentials to make choices, if there's nothing else to base the choice on. And as I have just suggested, this is exactly the situation in Libet's experiment, where there is no external central input nor any further reason to base a choice on or deliberate about. The subject's choice is not caused by the readiness potential, but the subject avails himself of the readiness potential as a trigger, because he has nothing else to go by. All of this is actually rather commonsensical and has already been suggested in other ways by some philosophers. I myself earlier felt reminded of the situation of Buridan's ass. If you know that, this is a donkey standing between two equally tasty haystacks, and the poor animal starves to death because there's no sufficient reason to choose one over the other. Now, in that case, one would literally grasp at any straw or suggestion to prevent oneself from starving. And one grasps at any kind of symmetry-breaking signal and allow oneself to be determined by just whatever else is going on. Buridan's donkey is indeed also the image that Alfred Mele invokes, while someone on Edward Faeser's blog nicely suggested that it is something like a mental coin toss. If we use such a mechanism and then confabulate afterwards that this was our choice, then even this is not entirely wrong. For we indeed chose the only rational course of action. We freely allowed ourselves to be determined by whatever else was going on in our brain. We do this, as Mele points out, in everyday life when we choose in the supermarket between two jars of peanut butter. There's no further reason to pick one rather than the other, so we let ourselves be determined by whim or whatever. And this is itself a rational and free choice. In all of these cases, we allow ourselves to be determined by causes, but this decision is not itself caused, but informed. And it is the intellect that provides the information, a formal and final causality. This is at least what Thomas Aquinas suggests. This is where rational deliberation comes in. And it is rational deliberation, not any kind of feeling, is then the evidence really for what that we have for free will. We make reasoned choices that become the cause of our actions, normative judgments that have an effect in empirical reality. And the very fact that we see empirical realities, which normally are subject to descriptive and deterministic laws, suddenly reflect our deliberations according to prescriptive and normative ethical laws, should come to us as a surprise, at least if we are determinists. In other words, our deliberations might formulate a duty that opens up a larger space of possibilities, and we are then free to either follow it or not. The space of deliberation is a space of possibilities. The moral law under which we deliberate transcends the determinisms of actual reality and demands of us that we do so as well. That is the argument of Immanuel Kant. And as he notes, this demand would have no obligatory force if we were not able to follow it. Ought implies can, as he famously says. Whether we follow these imperatives or not, they are the prime indicator that we have something like free will. Only free beings can experience themselves as a fact of reason, as Kant calls it, under the demands of unconditionally binding prescriptive laws with potentially counterfactual results. For Kant, this normativity is that of duty, of the moral law. For Thomas Aquinas, it is a normativity that is intrinsic to our rational appetite. Our will is a rational appetite, and precisely as rational, it cannot will something that is not good. The good is the formal object of this faculty, and we cannot choose anything except under the viewpoint of the good. It may only be an apparent good, but the will cannot choose evil for its own sake. We always choose everything as a good or as a means to a good end. The ultimate end is our human happiness, for nobody wants intentionally to be unhappy. And this happiness, as it turns out, is our participation in goodness itself, our rational participation in the life of God, who is the ultimate good. This is the root and nature of all of our willing, the voluntas ut natura, as Aquinas calls it in De Veritate. Everything else, every deliberation of free choice, or liberum arbitrium, is about the means to this end. This ultimate end constitutes the first principle of our practical reasoning, of which our actions are then the conclusions. These deliberations formulate the normative prescriptive necessities that come with our free will as a rational faculty. But just as the Kantian necessities, they are also what sets us free from the potential determinisms and necessities of the physical world or brain physiology. For everything, every particular action that we deliberate is indeed just this, a particular action or good, and not the universal good that is our final and ultimate end. About the latter, there cannot be any deliberation. It is a presupposition of all deliberation. The universal good itself opens up a space of possibilities, a horizon that is wider than any particular means that may serve this end. It therefore leaves us free and indifferent with regard to the choice of the various means that lead to the end. We can take them or leave them. It is precisely because the end is necessary that the means are contingent and subject to choices. This includes even the choice to refrain from choosing any of the means. Not only can we veto readiness potentials, but we can veto even our rational deliberations as long as they do not concern the ultimate good. In De Malo and in the Summa Theologica, Aquinas distinguishes between the freedom of exercise and the freedom of specification. The intellect specifies and as the formal cause informs our choices by its deliberations. It presupposes to us the result, for example, of a practical syllogism. This is what we know to be the good. What we know to be the good, and our will should therefore choose it by exercising its efficient causality. Yet this proposal of the intellect does not determine the exercise of the will, because short of the beatific vision, it proposes only particular goods that leave the will indifferent. The independent role of the will distinguishes Aquinas from rationalists like Leibniz, for example, and possibly Socrates. Okay, this I'm going on to explain a little bit how deliberation indeed is an indication of free will and what that entails. Now, what one should also say, if that establishes free will, is that for Aquinas, this free will is not without limits. He does not share exaggerated notions of free will as Sam Harris seems to require. Sam Harris says, consider what it would take to actually have free will. You would need to be aware of all the factors that determine your thoughts and actions, and you would need to have complete control over those factors. So according to Sam Harris's caricature, we would have to be in control of our genome, our prehistory, and perhaps the Big Bang itself in order to be free. That's not the case for Thomas Aquinas, who has a much more moderate and perhaps disappointingly commonsensical notion of our free will. That concerns, for one, anthropology, who we are, what our makeup is. And so Aquinas asks which parts of our human nature we can control by free will and how. To begin with locomotion. Obviously, we can move our body by locomotion, but there are limits in that we cannot make ourselves bilocate or levitate. The vegetative part of our nature is only partly in our control. Our digestion, for example, works independently from our will, for better or for worse. The heartbeat is not normally under our direct control. Breathing, on the other hand, can be done both voluntarily and involuntarily. About procreation, Aquinas disagrees with Augustine, who thinks that Adam and Eve before the fall could use their procreative organs by direct command of the will, without any passions being involved. When it comes to the external senses, of course, we cannot directly control what we sense with our external senses, but we can control our sense perceptions indirectly, namely by locomotion. For example, we can withdraw our hands from the hot stove when we feel the pain from the heat. This is actually important for our moral responsibility, for by our free will and locomotion, we can also withdraw from sources of temptation, turn off the computer, or avoid the occasions of sin, especially in those cases where flight is better than fight. The flight from sense perception is subject to the will, and therefore we are responsible for it. Similar things can be said about our internal senses. Things can come into our imagination, for example, and unbiddenly so. But we can distract ourselves by external occupation. But unlike the external senses, we can also, to a certain extent, redirect our imagination. These internal faculties begin to be somewhat more under the control of free will, just as we, unlike animals, can remember things at will. So our memory is also part of these internal faculties and subject to a certain extent to free will. So there's a certain control that our will has over our internal senses and passions, but it is only indirect. It is not often noted, but from all I can see, Aquinas consistently says that just as nothing can influence the will except through the intellect, so also the will cannot control other faculties except through the persuasion of the intellect. Thus, the will can, for example, not move or redirect our passions directly. Its rule over the sensual part of the soul is political, as he calls it, not tyrannical or despotical. It has to persuade the passions, as a speaker does in the parliament, by argument and rhetoric. Something of that sort we can also find suggested in contemporary psychology when it practices cognitive therapy. While this does allow for a certain control over our inner sensual state, this control, indirect as it is, does not lend itself to exaggerated notions of free will. But it is, for all that, not defeatist. It does imply, importantly, that our will is not identical with our feelings, since it can, to a certain extent, change them by the use of reason. In the reverse, our emotional life can affect our will, but again, only by distorting the intellect. The intellect is sort of the interface between our sensual nature and the will, so that it mediates both ways. The will has to use the intellect to persuade the emotions. The emotions can affect the will only by distorting how the intellect presents the object of choice. And that indeed can work with our brain physiology, and therefore that's a place where the psychiatrist can come in if there needs to be any kind of correction. Now, if we are in a psychotic state, of course, our mind is so distracted that we will not be able to make any rational choice, then indeed it is not a free choice. Even in this disastrous state, the free will, though, has still the choice like a veto. It can refrain from any decision, and sometimes it's actually morally the most responsible thing to do if we don't know what is going on, just to wait and see. Finally, what about the role of laws of nature in the relation to free will? We might not expect Aquinas to have an answer to this question, since the notion of such laws originates only in the 17th century. Yet there was an analogous notion even in Aquinas' day. We might not like to mention it because it sounds like superstition, but astrology was, for Aquinas, the best available science of his time. And it resembles modern laws of nature, at least in that regard, that the celestial bodies operate according to strict mathematical and geometrical laws. Whether circles or ellipses, whether heliocentric or geocentric, there is in the motion of the stars a certain ideal mathematical accuracy that we envision when we formulate our laws of nature in mathematical equations. The modern laws of nature are different only in the sense that they have now been extended to the terrestrial or sublunar realm, where they can consequently also be active in our human bodies and brains. And there they do exactly the same thing that Aquinas and others thought the heavenly bodies did. They influence our behavior by influencing our lower appetites. As such, one model is not necessarily more superstitious than the other. It is just that the best available science has shifted its focus. The relevant question for us is this. Is this influence deterministic? Thomas Aquinas does not think so. He invokes the classical principle astra inclinant non necessitant. The stars incline, but they do not necessitate. Comparably, we might say today that the laws incline us to certain behaviors, but that the indeterminacies of quantum mechanics allow exceptions, since they amount only to statistical probabilities. How that exactly works is a matter of speculation at different proposals. Aquinas thinks of the influence of celestial motions as a matter of propensities which generate probabilities rather than necessitation. Today we may consider such propensities to be the result of our genetic equipment or of our hormonal and neurophysiological predispositions, and we may replace our celestial character types with those of Myers and Briggs. But in either case, even given all these propensities, we still have a choice to make. Now, when it comes to this choice, Aquinas is surprisingly pessimistic. He thinks that most people will end up following these inclinations, and that only the wise will resist. Freedom is correlated with a degree of wisdom and education, and those without it may follow their first impulse and give in to the clickbait on the internet or the felt urge of their readiness potentials. Only the wise will rationally take a step back and activate their liberum arbitrium. Now, this might sound rather elitist, and it might self-servingly suggest that it is only the philosopher kings that should rule. But it could also be common sense. Even more than in Aquinas' time, we are now aware that it indeed conforms to the results of social statistics. These statistics can predict the rates of suicides, consumer preferences on Amazon.com, or crime rates, all of which presumably involve our free will and our responsibility. Early in the 16th century, the Jesuits were asking the question whether this implies that our choices are determined. Their answer was along the lines of Aquinas. Aquinas says about venial sin that even in the state of grace, we cannot avoid all venial sins. We can avoid each one at a time, but collectively we'll probably fall for one of them. And so statistically, collectively, there is an expectation that some things will happen. And so the Jesuits suggest the same thing. But just as we can predict how the numbers of rolling dice will turn out collectively and statistically, yet each roll of dice is independent and not determined by the others, so also each act of our free will remains free despite the statistic regularities. If statistically one out of 1,000 inhabitants of Madrid commits a mortal sin every day, this does not determine which one it is. And if at 11:59 p.m. nobody else has yet done so, then you are still not thereby forced to commit a sin. And again, there is common sense in this. We all have, by our nature, certain biological needs and urges, for example, for nutrition or procreation. And all things being equal, we will probably act on them. This is predictable. And it is not a matter of determination. It is simply the rational thing to do. If we are hungry, then we eat, unless we have further reasons not to do so. And perhaps the wise person might have more reasons of that kind. Eating when we are hungry might not usually require us to deliberate unless we are on a diet. And if looking back we confabulate some reason for why we did eat, then not even this is a mere confabulation. After all, it is rational to follow our nature, all things being equal. Looking back, we rightly think that it was the reasonable thing to do. Other inclinations might not be so rational. Since after the fall, many after our natural instincts are distorted by inheritance, the cultural environment, our own previous bad choices and other things may make these distortions predictably occur. They can also be predictably exploited and manipulated by advertisement and electoral campaigns on Facebook or elsewhere. If this did not work, people would not pay money for it. None of this would have surprised Aquinas, nor would it have made him question free will. There is no need to embrace exaggerated notions of free will for it to be real or for it to be considered to govern our life. Consider this. How often have you made a conscious, deliberate choice today? Maybe not terribly many. In our everyday life, we all develop routines that allow us to go on autopilot and disburden us from the need to make the same choices over and over again. For example, the choice which way to drive to work or to school. Routines are helpful. They also make our life predictable. Is this an argument against free will? In lesser matters, we may not consciously deliberate many actions anymore, yet in many cases, there was a choice that we did make initially. Even our routine habits continue to rest on earlier choices, and this is why we own them as ours. If we claim them and accept authorship for such actions, and if we give reasons for them, then this is not merely an ex post confabulation, but really the truth of the matter. As we have seen in the case of playing tennis, the initial deliberations and choices still govern our current behavior. We consider them to be the outcome of our self-formation and therefore take responsibility and own these actions as ours. As should be evident from this, free choices are not merely atomic, they have a history. As such, they can also govern large patterns of life. It is not as if there were only certain parts and perhaps too few that are under the influence of choice. It is not as if this were a zero-sum game between our free choices and the other parts of our lives. It is rather that our choices frequently govern the whole of a complex scenario and of habits and beliefs developed over time. And in fact, with such history, our freedom increases, because much of the prehistory that influences our choices will be of our own making, even if not to the extent that Sam Harris requires. As Raymond Tallis notes, freedom in this way gradually acquires content. Freedom and the self grow in parallel. Thus also Aquinas' account is not elitist, for even the wise man does not make conscious choices all or even most of the time. He would not be wise if he did. He even would lose some of his freedom if he wanted to choose everything consciously. For human nature and our routine habits free us to pursue wider goals without being stuck in the humdrum decisions of the day. They allow us to choose and deliberate about more important, more universal goods, as it befits a wise person. This sets us free, even though the most universal good of all is beyond our choice. For we all seek happiness, we all seek God. Thank you.
We have time for a few questions for Father Remlon.
Thank you very much. So when I think about free will, I try to do a thought experiment with somebody who doesn't have much. I'm thinking like a drug addict. Mm-hmm. And you said that, it's the free will act comes in the deliberation space, not in the actual act itself. It's when you're thinking rationally before you do something. Mm-hmm. Now, a drug addict can do that. They could deliberate all day and say, it's really not good for me to take drugs. And then they do it anyway. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's kind of an ill-formed question, but how does that fit into your paradigm?
Again, the limits of free will can come in on various levels. But I think even with a drug addict, I mean, you say they can deliberate all they want. They still make a choice, and the choice is based on how the objects of choice appear to them. And so if they are focused on the drug, and that's a physiological process, the space in which they live might narrow. So they will typically talk that way, that they start to live in a very narrow world in which everything is focused on the drug and nothing else seems to exist. So the space, this horizon of possibilities, shrinks. And so in that case, they will not see what the true good is, but only the apparent good. So I think there is actually a limit on the deliberate choice at that point, but of course they have a responsibility to think ahead and say, well, when do I put myself in that occasion, when that happens? What do I need to do to avoid that, going to an AA meeting or something like that? So there are deliberate choices one can make ahead of time, but when we are faced with a direct temptation, indeed, then our mind will play a trick on us.
The question that I have for you is with regard to an identity you seem to be formulating between space of rational deliberation and human consciousness. Mm-hmm. Am I correct in perceiving that you're claiming those as an identity with one another? And if so, can you please justify why you're collapsing those into an identity.
Now, what consciousness means, of course, that's another big question. I think that's also more than one thing. The rational deliberation would concern the intellect and our rational knowledge, but it always cooperates with our sensual faculties. Aquinas and Aristotle would be insisting on that. We're not angels, so we can only think in sensual kind of imagery. That means there are several things at play in our consciousness when we think about things. But what we do rationally is indeed we construct an argument that with premises and conclusions, and that follows the laws of logic. I don't know if that answers your question. I mean, could you?
There's increasingly convincing neuroscientific data that general intelligence is formulated from a series of neural mechanisms that are outside of conscious processes. And so I'm wondering if there's an opportunity here to expand a defense of free will by negating one of the naive assumptions that Leavitt makes, which is that our awareness is itself tantamount to the locus of origin for human freedom.
For one, I'm not sure there might be another talk on how our mind actually works with the brain, which is different from free will. Free will actually comes after that. Probably you shouldn't have started that. In any case, I would be very worried to say that our conscious processes by which we reason are sort of a side effect or occasioned by other kind of causes that are going on unconsciously. That would mean that our reason is dragged along by associations, by psychological laws, but not by the laws of argument. So there are, I invoked it at several points, and I didn't have time to explain that further, but one has to distinguish between prescriptive and descriptive laws. Descriptive laws are the laws of nature. They describe how things always invariably happen. Prescriptive law, and that cannot be broken. You know, if you try to break the law of gravity in jumping from a building, it's going to break you. You're not going to break the law. But prescriptive laws you can break. These are the laws of logic, of mathematics. You can fail a test, for example. You can break the laws of traffic or of canon law or whatever. The laws of logic are prescriptive laws. They're normative in that way, and we can fail to fulfill them. Now, our ability to follow such laws cannot be, they can be in conflict with deterministic laws. And if we are not free to follow that logic, if the deterministic laws drag us along, the descriptive laws, then we are not free to reason properly, and that includes doing science such as neurophysiology. So our very science that claims we are not free would be undermined by its own claims.
Okay, I'm a bit of a neophyte in this area, but my question follows on what he's saying. What is the difference between being your reason being dragged along by descriptive laws and whatever may be informing your rational processes through the interface of the intellect with the outside world? So if all of the descriptive laws are providing you with information from that interface, then why would that be, in essence, dragging your rational thinking? Why would it not be an informing? Why would it not be a way to inform that rational deliberation that you have going on?
Yeah, so the information obviously happens on deterministic laws. So, for example, if light waves hit my retina and they give me visual information about stuff about which I can then reflect, that's according to laws of nature. But I then reflect on that, and there's a further thought process which is not deterministic in the same kind of way, at least it cannot in the way that I said earlier. And free will is based on what the intellect then proposes. So it's an informed choice, and the information does involve other kind of physiological processes, obviously. But we act and make decisions in view of these, not by them. Right? And the view that we take of them are, in contrast with animals, a view under the universal good. You know, that is a universal kind of horizon, that any particular good that we can choose, Aquinas argues, does not fulfill this ultimate kind of good for which we are looking. And therefore it leaves us free, so after we are all informed, to make a choice to either do it or not to do it. That's where the will comes in, at the very end only.